It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we are here in studio again, on a glorious Saturday morning, which couldn't be timed any better given the nature of what's going on in town right now, which I always admonish everyone on this particular Saturday every year, that there are a lot of people from out of town hovering around the golf tournament. That means the roads and parking lots and restaurants are all very busy. Cut them a little slack because it is their intention to take out those big old American Express cards and leave a trail all across the town. Oh, and we should let them do it as easily as possible.
And from what I hear, the tour is charging a little bit more this year for the beverages. Right? Yeah. Well, they've definitely seen some inflation over in Ponte Vedra.
Yeah, well, good work if you can get it, I guess. Mm-hmm. Anyway, as always, welcome to the regulars. You know, we depend on you. That's why we keep getting up and doing this, and this into now our 11th year. And hopefully along the way there'll be some new people listening. If you are from out of town and you're driving out to the tournament and happen to have the station on, we talk about personal finance, investing, and that kind of thing. Just keep your radio on. Hopefully you'll pick up some pointers before you go out and have some fun mixing it up with the people out there. It's been an interesting tournament so far, and we're all sitting back with our fingers crossed because of that big front that's moving through the eastern part of the U.S. now. If we can just get it delayed or south enough that we can finish it up tomorrow, that would be great. But today, perfect. Absolutely perfect. So good luck to everybody out there. And all that said, we will, of course, have a trivia question after the break. And I'm looking for almost any excuse to not have to talk about the market, but I'm running out very quickly. So I told Adam right before the show, said I found three words to sum up the entire week. Friday was fun.
Yeah, that was really it. It was brutal. You kind of knew it was coming. We touched the prior week on an intraday correction for the S&P, but it managed to sneak back above that line to not close down 10%. And I just didn't think there was any way we were going to get away without this being a correction.
Computer programmers who do this stuff, we're going to do that. I am absolutely convinced.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
But it's okay.
Yeah, it's fine. The real question is what happens next? Yeah. And yeah, so are we in a bear market? I really don't think so. There's no driver for a bear market. Bear markets usually aren't driven by uncertainty alone, and this is being caused by uncertainty. Uncertainty definitely causes corrections, though, and that's what we've seen so far. It's been interesting in a lot of ways because right after the election, every major index was in overbought or extreme overbought levels. And today, every index is at extreme oversold. There isn't one exception on any major index. Everything is extreme oversold, meaning more than two standard deviations below its 50-day moving average.
Yeah, in fact, it was so bad, our gurus had to invent a new word because they've got the oversold and all kinds of stuff like that. But they called this one catastrophic. Catastrophic oversold.
When you get past
the two standard deviations, then they got to come up with words. And that's when they're writing that, it was Thursday. And by the time Friday ended, it's not true anymore.
Yeah, but it was true last week that one point that the NASDAQ was three standard deviations below its 50-day moving averages. That has happened before, but not very often.
Right. Well, it's known to be a bit more volatile.
Absolutely, yeah. So the markets did manage to fall for the week. The NASDAQ was down 2.4, the S&P down 2.3, and the Dow was down through 3.1. The Dow had been holding up better until this week. The Dow is down just 2.5% this year, S&P down 4.1, and the NASDAQ, the more volatile one that we just mentioned, is off 8.1. Last week, I mentioned that the VIX that's the fear indicator volatility index, had not reached the level indicating fear and panic in the market. But this week, we did top 28, which is the fear level.
Big number.
Yeah, that's where you really start to see things get a little crazy, I guess you could say. 30 is the extreme fear and panic level, so we didn't get to that. But as soon as we hit 28 this week, it dropped back down to just the high side of normal, and then by Friday it was down to 21, which is a normal level. For all of the declines, there really hasn't been a lot of panic in this drawdown, so that's a good thing. You do like to see a more orderly market. When you start seeing things like, say, when we had the COVID crash, where it was just panic, pure panic, people selling. That is not healthy behavior. That's extreme. This is not that at all. One interesting note is that while the declines have been sharp this year, they have actually been almost exactly in line with historical drawdowns in the indexes. And what do I mean by that? Well, the S&P is down just over 10% from its high this year. The average annual decline from a high in the S&P going back to 1953 is just over 10%. So on average, once a year, we see a drawdown of almost exactly what we have seen in the last 3 weeks. For the NASDAQ, kind of the same story. The average annual decline from a high is 14.8%. The current decline sits at 13.7%, so 1% away. After these declines from the highs, the S&P tends to bounce back over 20%, while the NASDAQ tends to rally 27%. So if you think all is lost, the truth is it probably isn't. Another interesting fact about bull markets is that if they make it past the two-year mark, they tend to last 5 years. However, the third year tends to be the worst year of a bull market. Guess what year we just entered? Year three. And sure enough, the pattern appears to be holding. The first 2 years of those bull markets tend to return about 60%, which we did. Mm-hmm. And the average gain for the entire bull market of 5 years tends to be 195%. So if the pattern holds true, we see volatility in the third year, we could be looking at some really good returns going for the next 2.5 years.
Yeah, and right now it's interesting about politics, because politics can drive the market, but only for a short time.
Yeah, we say that all the time. Politics is a short-term driver of the market, but it's absolutely not a long-term driver of the market.
Yep, it's exactly the same no matter when it happens. The thing that's different right now, and by different I mean probably more noticeable than it usually is, the difference in what people see, their attitude and what they believe will happen in terms of inflation, in terms of the economy, in terms of the market and so on. Republicans right now are wildly optimistic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, I think they're overly optimistic.
Absolutely.
On inflation terms, yeah. Especially. And Democrats are playing Chicken Little with each other on every front. They think inflation's going to explode, the market's going to go to hell in a handbasket, and that the economy will tank. There is no reason that either one of these scenarios should be anything like what will really happen, and yet it's this way, and it's all based on that. So we'll give you the more 30,000 look view down a little bit closer in just a minute. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we do have a trivia question, as usual, brought to you by Paul Lloyd at First Coast Alarm. You can call Paul at 904-636-7888. We are in a very, very taxation-oriented period of time right now for a number of reasons. One, tax day is a month from today. Everybody knows what that brings. And for another one, in Congress, the budgeting situation involves a lot about taxes. The expiration of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act through the arcane and, in my opinion, very stupid Senate rules has rendered that the so-called tax cuts from 2017, the Trump tax cuts, are scheduled to expire. Now, that never should happen. But because of the rules, they have to put an expiration date on it. So what's being talked about now is what it means if we just make those permanent. To the left, it means that we have to come up with $4.6 trillion of extra taxation or less spending. And to the right, it says, no, we don't. Nothing's changing. And we went over this last week. If nothing changes, then to me, you didn't get a tax hike. You didn't get a tax hike. Well, that's the kind of thing that's being one of the things that's being hotly debated in Congress right now. And I'm sure everyone was as surprised as I am that the package got through the first off the House, but then even more surprising perhaps in the Senate. So now at least we have a spending plan. There's no government shutdown coming, which I think was part of the big relief rally yesterday. And down the line now we have a lot of time to do actual budgeting, which they have promised to do. And quite frankly, I give it at best a 50% chance of working out. Yeah, there's nothing worse to me than a majority in either House and Congress on either side. Somebody will screw this thing up. I hope it's not us. But we need those tax cuts to remain permanent. In other words, we need our current tax rates to remain permanent. Otherwise, everybody in this country is going to average a 22% increase in their taxation. And in a time of inflation, high expense, and people just barely getting by, if that happens, it is going to be a real detriment to the economy. I don't think we need to drive ourselves into a recession by being stupid. And I hope they agree with me.
I kind of disagree with you. I think there's an 80 to 90% chance that the current tax law goes into effect for at least 10 more years or better. Those are all possibilities.
I just want the process to go away so that they become the tax law right now. So every discussion we have in the future is about changes to the current tax law.
Yeah. Well, that's I think, one big difference between you and me. You get very worked up about the process, and I could care less about the process.
That's true.
I just, you know, what's the result? Show me the result. I think the result is going to be 10 more years of lower taxes. So, yeah.
And then we'll face this again and we'll waste more time doing it. So I'm just really wishing that for some period of time that they would get their act together and look at it from our standpoint and from the standpoint of all the people that are listening to this broadcast today. Yeah, tell us what's going on. That's what we want to know. Don't keep coming up with this, maybe this and maybe that stuff. But anyway, that's life. I wanted to switch that over for the trivia question before I digress so far to one of the things that's going on right now with that tax deal. Is there's a lot of talk about Social Security. And one of the big problems we've had with Social Security, especially since the year 2000 and with all the inflation, is that the cost of living adjustments have never kept up to the actual cost of living. And that's for, you know, whatever reasons, mostly political and whatever. But every one of us, and I say us because I have been collecting benefits, and so is my wife for many years now. And when you see the little paltry increases you get every year and find out that they're mostly taken away by Medicare costs anyway, we are losing purchasing power big time. So one of Trump's current proposals is to eliminate all taxation of Social Security benefits, which I might remind everybody was the way the plan was written originally and the promise was made originally. If we were to eliminate all taxation, what percent of the deficit, I'm going to call it, the amount between our purchasing power in 2000 and right now that was based on those inferior cost of living increases, what percent of that gap, we'll call it, would be made up by eliminating taxes? It's between 1 and 100, and I'm not going to give you any more clues than that, but we will put it this way. It is a way to help Social Security recipients. It's not the total answer. That's why you know it's not 100.
Yeah, and well, I love the idea. The problem is funding. It's always funding because we have a spending problem. And yeah. So I don't know how you – so I the tax cuts, absolutely on board with, that we're just talking about, the overall tax structure, but the no tax on Social Security, great in theory. But, man, does that leave a big hole in the budget.
Yep. When you got a system that's going broken 9 years by most estimates, maybe 10, maybe 8, and you start improving benefits, and then you wonder, why are you supposedly fixing the system by making it worse? And you do have to wonder.
Yeah.
Adam made a very coherent discussion. I can't remember if it was in the office or on the show last week. You were talking about the size. It was an office discussion.
Okay.
But the size of generations, starting with mine and then going down through yours. And
oh, yeah. It's an hourglass.
This is interesting, by the way.
So the demographics of the U.S. look like an hourglass. The boomer generation, your generation, is huge. But you waited longer to have kids. So Gen X, my generation, was tiny. And so you had a kid two in that generation, and then one millennial.
Right.
She hates when I say that, so I have to bring it up.
I know, so we emphasize it.
But the millennial generation is absolutely huge. And so that generation is now in the workforce and growing their salaries, meaning that the funding, they're in their contribution to the funding of Social Security is going up. And then Gen Z is now entering the workforce as well. And they're a fairly large generation also. So I know they study all this as part of the funding studies, but it's surprising that because we have this generation, Gen X, who is now retiring, and they're a tiny generation, that we have such a funding problem. I think it has mostly to do with boomers living such a long time, which is great, but it also puts more strain on the resources of the Social Security system.
Yeah, in fact, in the next 20 years, the demographers are saying that the population of people in this country over 85 will double.
That's a significant reason that you have a funding problem.
Yes, and let's go back to the inception of Social Security and what the assumptions were back then. And they were correct back then. The life expectancy of Americans at the time was 65.
Yeah.
And the full benefit level was 65. So it was truly a survivor's thing. And most people who contributed for years and years didn't actually collect benefits unless they were early enough to do it at 62. Now, there was an early harbinger of trouble up ahead. Ida Mae Fuller was the very first recipient of a Social Security benefits check, and she lived to be 100. And she was a statistic, obviously, just by living to 100, but living to 100 then.
Yeah.
And she only paid in a few payments.
That's crazy.
Which she got back immediately. I think her benefit was something like $29.83 a month.
Wow.
For 35 years. Think about it.
Yep.
And cost of living increases and so on. But most people were doing their civic duty, I guess, and not lasting very long after they started getting benefits. That's all changed, of course, because now it's so common to see people in age groups much higher, and they have really only corrected the full benefit level by 2 years, and that was back in 83, 84. So we need to take a look at that and see if there's some adjustment we can make. Given advance notice, I was told something like 29 years before my 65th birthday that I'd have to wait a little longer than that. And that was okay because we were living longer, and so on and so forth. We have to do the same thing again. We have to do it without scaring the public. It's a very delicate system right now. It was built on the probability that we'd have a slush fund because more people would pay in than would take out. And that turned a couple, 3 years ago, and that's why the assumptions that we made are not adequate to keeping the system alive now. It's because we're no longer adding to the system.
The crazy thing about all this is that it's so easy to fix.
Yep.
Because we just need to stop doing Social Security for people who are teenagers or lower right now.
Yep.
And give them an individual account where you put 12.4% of their salary every year into a target date fund, and they would all retire millionaires.
George W. Bush, he brought that in front of Congress.
Yeah, and he immediately laughed off the stage. Yep, it was you're trying to ruin the system. But it's really that simple. If you set up a account for every kid who is alive right now and in the future and did that, problem solved. All you have to do is fund the everyone who's in the workforce now, and once they're gone, the problem is solved.
And it's really easier said than done, but it should be easy to do. But you really have to put out that same scenario that Reagan did in the 80s, where people all of a sudden saw what it meant. And this is going to happen. And it's going, here's who it's going to happen to.
Yeah.
Well, right now, if we let the system go unchanged until 2034, we'll say, everyone's going to get a benefits cut. And that means people who are collecting now. And since way too many recipients are living on that.
Yeah.
That is an unacceptable way to deal with the situation. And the problem is very simple. And I've said it 100 times on air if I've said it once. The problem is that from a political standpoint, if you try to fix it, you'll be voted out. And if you don't try to fix it, you'll be voted out.
Yep.
And that is a bit of a touchy thing. So, all right, back to more market things, especially when we get back. We'll just take a quick break, pay some bills. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
Kind of sneaks up on you sometimes.
Yeah, it does.
Especially when you're busy putting your nose in a book. Anyway, I want to remind everybody that lines are open, 904-222-8255 or 222-TALK, and we'll put you right on air. Trivia question's still there. What percentage of our purchasing power gap that was left by inadequate increases in Social Security could be corrected overnight if they just eliminated social or income tax on Social Security benefits payments? Between 1 and 99% of the problem would go away, at least for them.
Okay, I just did some quick math, too.
Yeah.
If you're 21 years old and you are going to work till 67, you currently make $35,000 a year, and that increases by 3% a year. And you can make 6% on your investments over that, over those years that you're working.
All reasonable assumptions.
Yeah. You saved 12.4% of your income in an account.
As is mandated today.
That's what Social Security actually is, because you contribute 6.2 and your employer contributes 6.2 on your behalf. You would retire at age 67 with a balance of $1.55 million.
And that's for someone making $35,000.
Yeah, $35,000.
Imagine today. If you made $100,000.
Right.
And we wouldn't have many paupers.
No.
At that point.
No.
Now, it'd be hard to tell what money is worth, but we only factored in Adam's calculation there, 6% growth. And over time, the averages are much higher than that. Yeah.
You could afford to then take out of that, this says about, in actual dollars, about $9,200 a month, but in today's money, that's worth about $2,374 a month. So, pretty astounding. I mean, you $1.5 million.
And in case the theory of this is too weighty for anybody to figure out, just look at our hopefully soon to be 51st state called Canada. They don't spend the money in the retirement system. They put it in the stock market and buy top quality, high dividend stocks, and they have more money than you can shake a stick at. And don't think just because nobody talks about that Trump isn't looking at that.
Mm-hmm. It's true. They do that very well.
Yes, right? They do.
There are other things that they do less well.
They're goofy as all get out in some respects, just like what we saw this week, but that's not what's really important.
Yeah.
They also have a vast wealth of natural resources.
Yes.
And they're not as afraid to tap them as we are. So, you know, this, I know this is an academic discussion and with a probability that's tiny, tiny, tiny. But at least if we could look at them and use them as an example for how you can do some things well, and then they could look at us and say, well, let's use them as an example for doing other things well, then maybe we'd all be better off up here. Who knows? Talking about maybe. Pie in the sky, huh?
Yep. So for such a bad week, there was actually a lot of good news. Started with inflation. And the every measure that I looked at came in lower or on par target or lower than expected.
Yeah, the worst case was even. Yep.
So CPI came in at 0.2%, which was 2.9% annualized. That was down from 4.3% annualized in January. And it really made the January data an outlier. I think it could have been a bad seasonal adjustment between when they go through the data, especially in January, they always do some sort of seasonal correction. it's you just don't see spikes like that in inflation data. It tends to be a very smooth trend. People don't raise and lower prices suddenly all the time. It tends to be a decision that takes place over a longer period of time. And so it was a weird spike in January. I think the current 2.9 is probably pretty accurate. The other bit of inflation news was that the PPI was at zero last month. It stayed unchanged from January. Trueflation showed an increase this week in the actual inflation rate, but just up to 1.73%. That was up from 1.3% last week. So, I mean, that's kind of a blip on the radar. That's not really even a big jump. That inflation did not come from the price of eggs, though, which dropped from $8.17 on March 4th to $4.90 on March 12th. That is a pretty significant decrease in the price of eggs.
Yeah, funny how little we hear about that, isn't it?
I can't imagine why.
Me neither.
Employment data also came in pretty positive this week. The JOLTS survey showed job openings appearing to have bottomed out late last year and potentially be on the upswing again. Hiring also looks to have ticked up from a bottom late last year. Initial jobless claims also came down this week from 242,000 to 220,000, well below that important 250,000 mark. And that included some government layoffs. So that is very important data to watch as we go through this slimming of the federal government.
Yeah, another piece of that, too, was in the sector breakdown. Manufacturing hires 2 months in a row now are perking up. That's very important because manufacturers pay people a lot better than a lot of the other, you know, the leisure hospitality group, that sort of thing. And if manufacturing is really ramping up, and a lot of people like Apple have announced they're building massive new expensive factories in this country, it's not going to be long, and you're going to see the construction people precede the manufacturing jobs because there's going to be so many things being built, and they pay very nicely also. I think that when you're looking for a recession in today's climate, you are probably going to have a little bit of trouble finding one. Doesn't mean that everything's perfect, but I do believe we're well on the way to better things.
Also, one thing to keep in mind when you hear about federal government layoffs is that the number that they're talking about is probably around 1 million people, which sounds like a lot, but you have to put everything in perspective. Every month in the United States from 2022 until now, roughly 4 million people change jobs.
Wow.
Every month. And so it's a quarter of the monthly turnover in the jobs data. Now, that includes people who switch jobs, new college graduates who enter the workforce or high school graduates that enter the workforce, retirements, people who die. I mean, that number, it contains a lot of things. But if you don't think that the U.S. economy can absorb 1 million jobs and move from the public sector to the private, I think you might be underestimating the size of the overall economy.
I absolutely agree. And we still have about 10 or 12,000 people every day turning 65. Some of those people are going to go into retirement anytime between now and, you know, 2, 3, 4 years out there. I think a lot of people have been reluctant so far because of the bad times we went through with COVID, but that doesn't keep them from getting older, and it doesn't prevent them from retiring as soon as they're feeling better about the world. So all that's very positive. I just can't see it pointing to a recession. And if they prove us wrong down the line, you hear it right out of my mouth with an apology. I just don't see it. Taxes coming up, I mentioned a month from today. I want to remind everybody, if you are one of those procrastinators and you have not filed your 21 returns yet, you have until April 15th to file a return back to 2021. And if you don't do it and you are owed a refund, you will not get it. It will go to the Treasury. Now, why do I bring it up? There is $1 billion in unclaimed refunds for the tax year 2021. You make sure if you're owed one that you can get it, because it's really easy to do. And if you don't, don't come crying to me, as they say.
Also, the sooner you file your taxes, the sooner you'll get your refund for 24. I just got mine this morning.
So, no kidding.
Yeah.
You're getting a refund?
Yeah.
What am I doing wrong?
No, actually, what am I doing wrong? I
hate yeah, well, you got a point there. Depends how you look at it. Interesting. One more little quick note. The tariffs have been the talk of the town, and the exact amount of good, bad, or indifference, nobody really knows. But I wanted people to understand something. And we were talking before the show with Roger a little bit about Canadian tariffs and so on. Canada charges us on butter a tariff of 298.5%. That is ludicrous. And it's not alone by any means. It's on a big, long list. But the one I bet nobody knows about, the home builders are crying in their soup right now because the lumber from Canada, they depend on it. How many of you know that Joe Biden put a tariff on Canadian lumber imports of 14.5%, I'm sorry. How many of you know that? Almost no one.
I had heard that before.
And the 25% it's going to, yeah, will it hurt? Sure. It caused a little ripple, but it's not a 25% change. It is a change of 10.5%, just so everybody's aware of that. All I care about is getting you the information so you get both sides of the story. Okay. After 4 days this week of abject misery in the market, Adam and I talked Thursday night and said, is it time for what we call the don't catch a falling knife discussion with the people? In our 11 years of doing our own business, which is, of course, now changed into get a little plug in here for Strivus Wealth Partners, the new company that does the same thing with the same people the old company did. But anyway, when we look out at the landscape and we go back over what we have worked with people to understand from the day they come in the door until now, is one of the biggest things we preach is to how to not panic when things start getting a little rough. And we have abided by that for a long time by not writing a bunch of times. That said, when it gets really uncomfortable out there, we have been known to send mass letters to friends, family, and, of course, clients. We discussed it, and I said, we'll draft one, and I hope we don't have to send it because Friday's good. I'll tell you the results of that right after a final break where we get a few bills paid. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I tell everybody the lines are open, 904-222-8255 or 222-TALK, where you could take a shot at our trivia question today. What percentage of our lost purchasing power in Social Security could be made up for by simply eliminating income tax on Social Security benefits? It's between, I'm going to narrow the gap for you, it's between 10 and 90. There, you should be able to just pinpoint it out of that, right? Or not, maybe. Anyway, I was mentioning, we have never made it a habit to flood the waves with newsletters and that sort of thing, because Lord knows there's a million of them out there and nobody could ever get around to reading them as much as they'd probably like to anyway. But we did talk on Thursday, and I set it to paper and then told Adam, I don't really want to have to send this. If Friday opens well and stays well, then I think the thing is kind of moot. But I wanted you to know what we were all thinking, so I'm going to hit a couple highlights from it. And it started out, it explained how people know we're not in the habit of writing and distributing frequent mass emails when the going gets tough. We understand that people have experienced in short-term market volatility and they've watched things happen for their own portfolios. And we got to go to the lines here. Good morning. Is it Alonzo?
Yes, it is.
Good morning, Alonzo. What's happening?
I wanted to call in and ask a tariff question. I wanted to throw it at you guys and get your response.
Sure.
There's been a lot of news lately about the use of tariffs. So I wanted to ask if you could explain, is the president using the tariff instrument as like a bargaining chip? Is he dangling it in order to get some other thing from the people we put tariffs on? Tell me whatever you might know.
Yeah, that's a great question.
We'll give you the long answer and the short answer all at once. Yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah, the answer is yes. The problem is that he can't.
Fire.
The uncertainty in the market is being caused by the tariffs. The president can't go out and say, I am putting these tariffs on in order to achieve X, because then he loses all his leverage in the negotiation. And so that causes a great deal of uncertainty. Imagine being a home builder right now and trying to forecast the price of a home that you're building with Canadian lumber in a month, because you don't know if the tariff's going to be 12%, 14%, 25%, 100%. There's no way to do it. That is why the market is freaking out. And that is also, but it hopefully is part of a longer term plan to achieve some goal that he can't come out and say, because it would give away the game and he'd lose all his leverage. And so I think that's what he's doing. I'm pretty sure that's what he's doing. Would you agree with that?
I don't disagree with one word. He is a fair trade person. I'll go back a few years. I'll tell you a little story, partly on myself, I guess. But I've been doing this kind of talk radio for 23 years, I guess. And long time ago in the 90s, we had a caller at a different show in a different station. And it was a young guy who was really on our case about NAFTA, because NAFTA had just been passed. And I was arguing with him based on the statistics that I knew, which was since NAFTA had passed, many, many jobs, hundreds of thousands of jobs had been created in America. His counter was they're the wrong jobs. Factories are closing. You can't support a family anymore on what you're making if you're doing the burger flipping or whatever. And I basically shut him down, saying you're not entitled to your own facts. You said the jobs are going away, and I say the jobs are going up by numbers. If I could find him, I'd apologize, because in the big scheme of things, he was right. The wrong jobs were leaving, the right jobs, I guess, were leaving, right for us, and the wrong jobs were being created. And the wrong jobs, it's never wrong to get new jobs if you have particularly young people coming in who want to take them, but it's wrong in the long run to get rid of the higher paid, higher skilled jobs. Now, I didn't realize it, because I had followed NAFTA and the negotiations pretty carefully. And we were not well informed about the result of that. Come to find out, which we found out during Trump's first term, NAFTA was really a raw deal for America. And when Trump came in and renegotiated NAFTA and called it the USMCA, it was much more fair to the U.S. than the old one. As some time went by, cracks in the armor started, and people started finding out, well, you know what? We still don't have fair trade. Fair trade and free trade go arm in arm. And what happens today is that countries like Canada, Mexico, the EU, et cetera, charge massive tariffs on American exports. We don't charge massive tariffs on imports from those countries yet. Trump has just put the hammer down, and what we want is that we will pay and they will pay the same amount, and the ideal amount is zero. So my original premise was good. Let every country do what they do best at the most reasonable cost, and everybody wins. And that's true then. It's true now. I still believe it, but I didn't understand why it wasn't being practiced. So again, I publicly apologize to the young man, and I learned through people like Laura Ingraham, who was on this case for years, and through Donald Trump and so on, what the real truth of the matter was. And I hope it's taking a massive step toward getting it figured out. So I hope that enlightens you a little bit anyway.
Yes. Would you say that fair trade and free trade can influence one over the other at some time or other?
I think, yeah, definitely. Then it's going to depend on the product.
Then if that's the case, I think that the president may be doing this not as a means of an immediate goal, but something that is long term, even beyond his 4 years, where he can create some leverage or negotiate something with the other countries by utilizing tariffs to some extent or another. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'd give you a PhD in economics right now.
Well, then I ignore the liberal media going all kinds of back and forth, and I'm thinking he's looking at this much more strategically, much more in the way of what how can this affect us 4 years from now, 8, 10 years from now, not just today, tomorrow, the next day. That's my thinking.
Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely. And think what it'll do to our cost of living if all those tariffs start to come down and eventually dissipate. It's going to be good for everyone. And I think that's the bottom line here is we want to do what's good for everyone, including foreigners.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean.
Okay, great then. Thank you so much for the time.
Oh, great call. And you're a very insightful person. We really appreciate you calling in. We appreciate you listening. Thanks so much. You know, it's a tough discussion, I guess, because nobody really knows what goes on out there until you start to get wind of it. And when we sell a car to Germany and it gets taxed at 30%, they sell one to us and it gets taxed at 2%, we're not winning.
Yeah, exactly. And then combine that with the fact that Trump can't even talk about what he's doing, and it just gives so much for the liberal media to jump on and criticize over when they don't know any better than we do.
So true. Anyway, back to our non-letter, we went on to say that this week and this month have been difficult to watch, and we understand that the correction took place, and we both believe that it was a needed correction, if for no other reason than people were expecting it, and many people are trying to cause it, I believe. And they're not uncommon, close to once a year, and that's the way it is. We understand that markets detest uncertainty, and we know that every day in the market there is uncertainty, but there are a lot of things happening positively, both at home and overseas at this very moment. And we think things will be pretty good, but if you're doing business with us and you got comments to make, we're always reachable and we'll discuss whatever it is that's on your mind. But if Friday's any indication, I think we have really hopefully turned a corner. Will it last? I'll talk to you next Saturday. All right, if we were to actually get the proposal through to not tax Social Security benefits, about 60% of what we'd lost in purchasing power due to inadequate COLAs would be restored overnight. The good news is that it's 60%. The bad news is it's not 100%. And the worst news is it all goes to the people who pay taxes on Social Security benefits, and the real problem is the people who are just barely surviving on it, who pay no taxes on their Social Security. They receive no benefit from this proposal, and therefore, I think we have to find a better way.
I agree. It just doesn't seem feasible.
No, it really doesn't. Or even maybe, right. See you next week. Thanks for listening. Go have some fun. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour.